Welcome to the AI and Faith podcast. We are a community of expert technologists, professionals, and faith leaders bringing the ancient wisdom of the world's major religions to the ethics of artificial intelligence. Join us on this new journey and welcome to the conversation.
What we see right now is a simulation of intelligence. And in the kind of classic example, I find it compelling that just because you create a simulation of a hurricane, it doesn't mean that there's wind, right? So you can have something that resides within the circuitry of a computer that simulates a lot of different things. That doesn't mean it is really the thing. So we're certainly not there now. I don't think we're likely to be there anytime soon. Is it possible? I don't know.
Welcome to the AI and Faith podcast. I'm Kenneth Cukier. I'm a journalist at The Economist, but more relevant to this context, I'm a member of the AI and Faith community. And I am thrilled to present this episode, an interview with Tim Dalrymple. Tim leads the John Templeton Foundation, which works at the intersection of science and spirituality. He is a deep thinker on theology and technology, and I prepared a set of careful questions. But his first comment threw me to such a degree that I ditched the list entirely and began probing his views. I hope you enjoy the episode as much as I enjoyed talking with Tim. I begin with a short biography of Tim, and then we launch right in. Enjoy the episode.
Tim has had a somewhat legendary career that has buttressed both the worlds of science to some degree, certainly of media and of religion. Now, he received his bachelor's degree from Stanford, which is in the heart of Silicon Valley. He received his master's of divinity at Princeton Theological Seminary, the institution, not the seminary, but Princeton, where Jeff Bezos went to school. And he got his PhD from Harvard University, the institution where Zuck and Gates both dropped out of. Not the divinity school, but of Harvard. So clearly he has been in the proximity of tech royalty. Now, if we go back many, many years, his first love was of physics. And indeed, he once dressed up for Halloween as Stephen Hawking. But since then, he founded his life has taken another arc in terms of thinking about theology, about religion. He worked at Patheos.com, which was a groundbreaking institution on the web, trying to bring religious communities together to talk about spiritual matters. And so he could see the benefits of technology through that, but also, of course, the problems, because you can't go very quickly into the world of digital media without seeing how it can also tear people apart. Tim just recently was named to Time 100's philanthropy list to suggest that his work is not yet complete. But he's also known for most people having done his previous job, not the one that he joined at the Templeton Foundation just a year ago this month. And that was at Christianity Today, in which I think for anyone who's been following Christianity Today over the last few years, the last half decade, has known that there's been an extraordinary transformation. Sure, if you look at numbers like profits are up, assets are up, readership is up. In a challenging media environment, I can, as one editor to another, I can tell you that that's not easy to accomplish. But he defined himself as a courageous and fearless editor, taking on hard subjects and difficult institutions, including his own. So he is the person who is best suited to think deeply and hardly about the topic in front of us now, which is AI and faith. So, Tim, thank you very much for joining us. What I'd like to do is unfairly foist your own words upon you to decrypt it for us. And I'm going to mention that when you were first named the leadership of the Templeton Foundation, you had said, and I quote, "We live in a world hungry for purpose, where the lines between science, spirituality, and moral imagination are converging in new ways. The insights we gain and decisions we make in the next 10 years could have profound civilizational effects." What did you mean by that?
Well, I think that the topic that AI and faith deals with is a really beautiful illustration of the moment of extraordinary peril and extraordinary potential that we occupy. And I want to start by saying I've been a fan of the AI and Faith project for a number of years. And I was introduced to it through David Brenner, one of the co-founders. And I remember when it first came up, I was asking David, why don't you just make it AI and technology? Because there's such a great theological tradition of reflecting on technology and its place within the cultivation and restoration of all things. And David, his response at the time was something along the lines of, well, actually, I think AI presents some really specific ethical challenges, and it's going to be integrated into so many different technologies going forward that I think being specific about AI and faith makes a lot of sense. And I'll just confess that I was skeptical of that response at the time. And it turns out David is quite the prophet because he was 100% correct about that. But one of the things that really excited me about coming to the John Templeton Foundation, due to the intellectual adventurousness and the capacious curiosity of our founder, Sir John Templeton, it engages such a broad variety of different areas. And those areas span from my fields, which are more in the philosophy and ethics and theology space, all the way into through the social sciences, sociology and anthropology, into the hard sciences of physics and mathematics and biology and life sciences and so on. And as you guys appreciate more than maybe any other group, artificial intelligence, machine intelligence is so rapidly transforming the landscape that we collectively inhabit as human beings that it raises really, really profound questions about what it means to be human and the kind of course that we want to chart for human civilization. Now, I'm old enough to have gone through several technological revolutions that didn't necessarily prove to be as consequential as we thought. So I remember when it seemed as though blockchain was going to change everything. And certainly it has changed some things, right? I don't know if it was quite as transformative or hasn't been yet as it was touted to be. Or the metaverse was going to change everything. That certainly hasn't, you know, happened yet. I think with artificial intelligence, and we're further along, you know, that's been percolating for a very many decades now. I think it is quite likely that we are going to look back 10, 20, 50 years from now and see this decade as a decade that altered the course of human civilization, the kind of world that we inhabit as a species. Now, it might not prove to be that consequential, but I think there's a high likelihood that it will. So coming to a place like the John Templeton Foundation that lives in the at the intersection of the humanities and the sciences seemed like, to me, a really important opportunity to be a part of that conversation.
Let me go right into that. It looks like the sciences are winning. It looks like the humanities are losing. What do you see?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know if it's a competition or needs to be a competition. So we certainly want them to be mutually enriching and mutually informative and to greet one another as friends and different and mutually complementary paths to a positive future. So there's a sense in which, you know, we are scientific beings, right? That is a part of what it means to be human, is to be a scientific and even a technological being, to develop new insights, to follow our curiosity into new discoveries, and to develop new tools that extend our capacities to affect the natural environment. I mean, I think the humanities should, I know that I kind of talked about this meeting place. Maybe we're reintroducing two kind of streams of thought that have, unfortunately, we have tended to treat as separate, but that really need to be informing one another. So my sense is that we have spent a lot of time, and the John Templeton Foundation has been involved in trying to help the humanities receive what science has to say. I think we're at a point now where a lot of people on the side of the sciences and technology are eager to hear what people from the humanities have to say, because they are wrestling with the kind of profound ethical and human questions that are raised by the technologies that they are developing into the world.
So I have a profession in which I'm allowed to be dyspeptic and cantankerous.
Having worked with a lot of journalists, I can confirm you on that point. Yeah,
indeed, indeed. Also, I say it's a formation, it's a deformation professionnelle, right? It's a professional deformation. So I don't want to lean into it as a contrarian, because that's both cliched and often wrong and a little bit intellectually weak. However, if you remember from the 50s to the 80s, there was the C.P. Snow versus Jacob Bronowski debate between these two universes of the humanities and the sciences. And there was a sort of a compact that was put together saying it's neither one or the other. And in fact, the debate seemed very superficial when you looked at it. And in fact, the Templeton Foundation was one of the great leaders putting forward this idea that if actually you look at a lot of the best scientists, they're all people of faith. So it's more complicated than we felt. But I do believe that the world is slightly different. And what I'm seeing in Silicon Valley is an entire cast of, and I mean that with an E and without an E, cast of people who are almost preternaturally devoid of the humanities, are living in a world of a hyper-scientism where they actually see that human beings are just machines, in the words of Daniel Dennett, robots made of robots made of robots. And what they're making is just a better human being that will have all the properties of a human being, and they call it AGI, artificial general intelligence. And I think for many people in the pews that and around the world, that worries them.
No, I think which is fair. So that is definitely a stream of thought that I have found at some of the universities that you mentioned earlier, as well as in the water in Silicon Valley in general. I would say that there's an equally robust stream of thought that is wrestling with and trying to develop paths forward for just a version of what flourishing humanity looks like in an increasingly technologized era. In a time when we spend so much time on our screens and where we can augment our intelligence and have access to so much information in so little time and at such little cost. What does it mean for us to be fully alive within that context? How can these tools enliven and expand our capacities for creativity and for compassion? So I do sense, you know, there is certainly kind of a reductive approach amongst some, but I don't yet have the view that that is the dominant stream of thought. If you take a look at somebody like Steve Jobs, I think part of what made him so successful was precisely this kind of unification of the sciences and the humanities. So he was a technologist. He was somebody who commanded the work of a great many computer scientists, even if he wasn't precisely a computer scientist himself. But part of what was so important about him and what made him so successful was understanding the human component and understanding design and intention and how does something make you feel and how does it connect with you and enhance your life. Now, we can all debate whether the devices that he pioneered have done so. But I think that him, I would say Dario Amodei as well, is somebody that I feel like is trying to kind of live at the intersection of those disciplines. And even at, you mentioned that Stanford is kind of at the heart of Silicon Valley, and that's certainly been true historically. You know, there are great efforts there around human-centered AI to incorporate training in the humanities for people who are in the computer sciences, right? And as one commenter noted here, you know, we have encouraged an entire generation to go into computer programming, and now we probably need fewer computer programmers. We may actually see a flow back into the humanities. And if it's true, which it may not be, but if it is true that machine intelligence and eventually robotics and so forth increase the time for leisure and for self-expression, then again, that may actually prove to be a blessing to the humanities as well.
There's so much I want to pick up on. I'll mention three points and then come up and then ask another question, which is the first is that it's interesting that you invoke Steve Jobs because part of his personality was and who he was as a leader was very much developed based on him being a practitioner of Zen Buddhism. So it's interesting that spirituality is deeply wedded into his character as well. In the case of Dario, although he's well known as an AI pioneer and his PhD is in bioinformatics, he studied literature as an undergraduate. So he actually comes from the humanities background. So many other people, however, don't. So he might be the exception that proves the rule. And in the case of Stanford AI teaching the humanities, I see that a little bit as like MBA programs teaching ethics. Let's see where that goes, right? That seems
like... The proof will be in the pudding.
It'll be a superficial quality. But I want to pick up on the idea that we're really vaunting the humanities. Isn't that interesting? Because 400 years ago, 600 years, actually about 600 years ago, we'd be very apoplectic. The humanities, studata humanitatis, why that's against something. It's against studata divinitas, right? The humanities and contrapose to spiritual canon law on one hand, but spirituality on another. Maybe we need to go beyond the humanities. Maybe we need to teach religion.
Well, this certainly, you know, the development of AI and the way in which there is a subcategory of fans of the development of AI that take it in a very religious direction, right? And I think we do need to wrestle with how do we think about these topics from a faith perspective, whatever faith community we're coming from, and how do we understand what it is that's actually emerging without kind of divinizing it or taking it to be something that it's not or to be more than it actually is. And there is a pseudo-religious kind of almost adoration of this emerging superintelligence that I hear sometimes, and that I hear from people who are also, I have begun, for instance, I won't say who it's from, but I have begun to submit my life to the artificial intelligence because it knows what is good for me better than I will ever know what is good for me, which is very religious language, right? And people gathering in groups that are almost like they're looking toward the end times, or this is the arrival of some kind of messianic figure. And, you know, I think that carries it a little too far. I think we should be sober. So you've probably picked up, I am essentially a techno-optimist, but I also think we should be sober and realistic about what is emerging, what it's not. Within that space, though, I think there's a lot of room for, you know, I come out of the Christian tradition, a lot of room for Christians like myself and people within their own traditions to look at how is the technology story depicted within that community and within that tradition? How do we understand it and its possible use for redemptive purposes? How, in light of this vision of a theological anthropology or what it means to be human in relation to God and in relation to others, how does that inform what we want out of this technology? So that goes beyond ethical and social questions, certainly into the theological.
Let's go into the theology. I know you've been thinking long and hard about this issue. Many people look at artificial intelligence, the very nature of it. Yes, there's the idea that there's people who are starting to sort of worship it in a metaphoric sense, not in a real sense, but still it seems like it gives rise to the sort of idolatry and blasphemy and sacrilege that has been warned about for centuries. But at the same time, they look at what its mission, what it proposes to be and do to create something artificial that is intelligent, that is makers sometimes argue will be conscious. And for the tech bros, they see this as the sort of manifest destiny of humanity to evolve into what's called Life 3.0 by Max Tegmark, the sort of a new mechanical species of humanity, that we have been the forebears of this new dimension of evolution in human existence that is now becoming first cyborg and then non-human. But for people of faith, they see it as the golem, as something that is actually cursed. You have looked deeply at scripture and at what it has to say about the artificial and what it has to say about intelligence. Where do you come down? How should people of faith, let's start with Christianity and maybe extend it more broadly, but maybe just talk about Christianity. How should they think about artificial intelligence? And should they actually feel that it's some sort of an affront to what it is to be human?
Yeah, so I would place artificial intelligence within the broader theological reflection on technology. And one thing about the Hebrew scriptures in particular is that they present a technological story, right? From a kind of pre-technological state described in the opening chapters of Genesis to an increasingly technologized reality. And there's no reason to believe, you know, if we take these kind of paradigmatic early stories of Eden, for instance, that as kind of expressing something that is essential and original to humankind, there's no reason to believe that there would not have been some at least primitive tools available or developed during that time as God charged humankind to join with him in the continued creation and cultivation in bringing greater order and fruitfulness, productivity, and abundance into the natural world, right? And so we often imagine that that was an entirely pre-technological reality, that as though fruit would have just fallen off the trees and everything was just so fruitful and so abundant that there was no need for tools. Actually, that's a bit of projection on our part. We have no idea, right? And it's not unreasonable to think that there might have been tools. And that's essentially the way I understand technology, as a tool or technique that extends our capacity to manipulate the natural environment. So you go from that to, you know, there's a whole theological tradition that views God as the first technologist as well for the development of clothing. And so this is after the fall, and God is giving clothing or garments of skins, textiles essentially, to his children. Then you have the development of weaponry and clearly other kinds of agricultural technologies. You have the development of cities, which isn't possible without the use of technologies and is a kind of technology in itself. You go on to things like the Ark and the Tower and new brick-making technologies, and you could follow that story through. And it's essentially just, it's a part of the fulfillment of that human vocation to cultivate and develop the world. And then in the landscape that is affected by sin, also to participate in the redemption and restoration of all things. So I like to see AI within that broader stream of humankind's use of technology. And now there's nothing that says that every technology is always going to be beneficial, right? And in most cases, we can think of all sorts of applications where there are beneficial and non-beneficial uses, and technologies developed for good things can be used for evil. So I should be clear here that I'm just speaking as an individual. That organization that I lead now, it's not a Christian ministry. It is, you know, broadly open, but coming out of kind of the tradition that I come out of, I think I have a really rich sense of the import of technology and the fulfillment of what it means to be human. And you follow that forward into the New Testament, into the use of emerging technologies of transportation and navigation and so forth. It's really essential to the spread of the good news from a Christian perspective, right? Follow that through church history or through religious history. And the religious communities that have flourished have tended to be the ones that make good use of emerging technologies that allow them to propagate their message further and faster. Now, with artificial intelligence, I think there's all sorts of opportunity to do that. Does it present some problems that are distinct from earlier technologies? That would be, I think, the next question. And I would say potentially it does, right? So when we're talking about disruptions to the workforce, for instance, people often bring up, well, nobody complains that all the people who took care of horses had to get different jobs, right? Well, okay, that's one technology development. We'll talk about the car that was disruptive within a certain space. This has the potential to be disruptive across practically every space, right, on a certain timeline. So it may be distinct in that sense. It may also be distinct if it actually proves to be the case that we are creating intelligences or conscious beings, which I think is yet to be determined. I haven't actually seen evidence for that yet. I see this as augmented intelligence. I see this as an extension of human intelligence, different expressions of, you know, different tools, different applications. I think we find ourselves in fundamentally different waters if it becomes the case that we are creating distinct beings who are in some respect separate from us and have their own agency and their own self-consciousness. That may be the case. We may get there if intelligence is just if consciousness or personhood is an emergent property from certain kinds of interactions. But I don't think we know that yet. I don't think we have strong evidence that that will be the case. I'm not afraid of it. If it proves to be the case, then I think in some ways we are recapitulating, and that, you know, we talk about in the Judeo-Christian tradition, we talk about being made in the image of God. Is there anything more in the image of God than creating an intelligent being? Well, maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe that's actually a great fulfillment in some ways. And would that being fall away from us in the same ways that we fell away from our maker? Well, maybe so, right? But again, that's all highly speculative and depends on things that are not yet in evidence. But I also just don't think we should be afraid of it.
I think we need to double click on this.
Sure.
Pardon my French, but as a young journalist, I was told by a very senior editor, there's two kinds of stories in the world, no shit and holy shit. And what you just said is really quite radical from a theological standpoint. you're actually suggesting that that which was a machine and created of inorganic parts could actually have be conscious and then have a sort of personhood, have agency, and have that personhood is an emergent property that would have agency and intelligence, but it would have been created by man. Now, it seems to me that it would be lacking something that those of people of a spiritual nature would say that it needs to have to actually be endowed with this sort of enwrapped and enrobed love that we owe to it, which is a soul, a spirit. I know you're not dumbing down, you're obviously not dumbing down religion. We're having a conversation, so I'm not criticizing you. I'm trying to understand it better. How would you bring together your knowledge of, and your maybe personal beliefs of faith and the transcendental and God with the idea that there's that which was inorganic and created a tool from the touch of man, touch of a human, that then could actually emerge? For me, it seems like it's actually a category error. I can't prove it, but I sort of know it, you know it when you see it, you feel it in your soul. How do you see the world?
Yeah. So what I actually said is that there's no evidence yet that there is, or might even be possible, the creation of a separate agent and being, center of personhood and so on. But if that does prove to be possible, then I think there are theological traditions for wrestling with it. So I'm like you, that when I think there's a lot of conceptual and terminological confusion and a slippage between intelligence, agency, personhood, conscience, consciousness, sentience. These are terms that need to be more clearly defined. And what we see right now is a simulation of intelligence. And in the kind of classic example, I find it compelling that just because you create a simulation of a hurricane, it doesn't mean that there's wind, right? So you can have something that resides within the circuitry of a computer that simulates a lot of different things. That doesn't mean it is really the thing. So we're certainly not there now. I don't think we're likely to be there anytime soon. Is it possible? I don't know. That's where I would like to exercise some epistemic humility or systematic humility. But I am saying that even if it proves to be the case, I think there are good theological resources for wrestling with that. So some people find that would be, well, if we were actually to create intelligences, by which I mean a kind of center of consciousness and intelligent action in the world, that would be an arrogation to ourselves of the place of God. I'm not sure that that's true. There's a different way of thinking about it theologically in which that is, again, a kind of participation in what it means to be made in the image of God. So let's say 50 years from now, let's say that that does happen. I don't mind contemplating that reality or developing some theological resources for that eventuality if it should ever happen.
I don't want to dwell on this too long, but I also don't want to give it up too soon.
Sure.
Just because it's so deeply interesting. I'm sure all of us know the book, The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. And what's so interesting is that it's a highly scientistic approach. So to channel my inner Dawkins, I don't respect Dawkins, don't buy into the book, but to channel my inner Dawkins and bring it back to you, what if in, let's say, 100 years, that we find that we have created this entity that indeed has all the properties of life, but it's super intelligent, so it's even more human than human life. It has a consciousness that's a millionfold more conscious than the mere ant-like consciousness that we have right now. And then it tells us, oh, sorry, you guys still think that God exists. Guess what? I'm so super conscious and so super intelligent, I can tell you, actually, there is no God. It was always just a figment of your imagination. How would those people who are religious feel about it? And would that actually satisfy as the answer that an uber rationalist has used reason to calculate that there is no God, where people use a different faculty of their body and mind and soul to actually reason that it feels like there is something more than just the physical world?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting scenario to contemplate. We could also contemplate the opposite scenario where a super intelligent being who was kind of ultimately traces back in its lineage to human creation comes to the opposite conclusion, right? And says, I've processed all of the information, I've delved into it as deeply as possible, and I am going to tell you it's overwhelmingly likely that there is a creator or something, you know, along those lines. And it could go either direction, it could go in unanticipated directions. I wouldn't, you know, my sense as a person of faith is that if I'm wrong, I want to be the first person to know. But I will say that I think there are sources of information and knowledge and that are a little less easily quantified. So there are sources of experiential knowledge, for instance, existential knowledge. I think part of the invitation to Christians, for instance, and again, the position that I occupy now is not limited to kind of a Christian practice, but within the Christian tradition, there are things that you come to know through community and through experience and through the imitation of the life of Christ, or in relationship with Christ, in whom you come to know the fullness of God, right? That is not reducible to kind of the amalgamation of extraordinary amounts of data and then operating algorithmically upon it. So I think that it's a richer picture of how we actually come to know things. Now, could there be a future in which some superintelligence is also able to incorporate those things? Maybe. I guess we'll just have to see.
I want to remind everyone that what's old is new, and that, of course, we're not the first ones to think about this, and that there is a short story by Isaac Asimov. I'm sure some of you may know it. Yeah. And I won't give it away. It's a very short, you should read it, but it goes right into the very heart, pun intended, of the matter of what we're talking about right now. And I'll let you read it because you have to read it to the end to enjoy it. Let me pick up on one thing that you've said. So you told us that quite beautifully that religious people should not feel any compunction not to use technology, since after all, we've got all these great benefits of technology. Even the very temple that we've built is architecture and therefore is technology as well. My question to you would be, is there any way in which you would counsel people, religious groups, not to use AI specifically, and why?
Yeah, and I hope while I've conveyed a general sense of openness to new and emerging technologies and creative and redemptive uses of those technologies, I've also kind of sounded the note that there are evil uses of technologies. And it's not the case necessarily that, I mean, there might be some technological products or technologies we develop that are very hard actually to use in creative or redemptive ways. Sometimes when I'm talking with people about the ethical or theological dimensions of technology, I'll ask them, you know, what are some technologies that you think have been overwhelmingly beneficial in their impact? And sometimes people will come up with penicillin or with air conditioning or something like that, which still has some downsides with the energy use and all that. But if I ask them, what are things that have, if you could go back, would you take away? One thing that comes up a lot is actually social media. A lot of people say, I would rather that social media had never come along. As you guys know, so much of social media is driven by AI algorithms. And in a lot of ways, the early phase of social media, prior to the application of so many algorithms, was, I think, better. There was this idealism around social media as it was emerging. And I was as you mentioned, I was at Harvard. I wasn't at the Divinity School. I was at the School of Arts and Sciences, but I was there as the Facebook was emerging. And, you know, there was this sense that we were going to democratize social discourse and it was going to allow the elevation of voices that had not been heard, and we were going to interconnect people. And obviously, you know, the very early moments of the Facebook were a little bit more about kind of, you know, social dynamics within colleges and things. But then there was this bigger vision of the positive that it could bring. And that was when I left academia to be a part of the entrepreneurial enterprise you mentioned of Pathios, because we thought, hey, let's use these tools to create a better conversation around life's most important questions. And it felt like we were doing good things there for the first several years. And then you had kind of the application of these algorithms and that were all about maximizing engagement and data collection in order to micro-target, you know, gather as much analytics as possible so you could be as targeted as possible with advertisement and analytics. And maximizing engagement, the easiest way to do that was, you know, what Tristan Harris calls the race to the bottom of the brainstem, and to play to people's fears and their antipathies and their tribalism. And so that has had extraordinary negative consequences from my perspective, right? Now, similarly, when it comes to AI, yes, of course, there are going to be all sorts of ways in which we should be very, very cautious. So there are ways of utilizing AI that I think expand our sense of humanity. There are ways of utilizing AI that are reductive and divisive and destructive. So I think whether we're thinking about us as individuals, mental health, thinking about families and mental health and connectedness, thinking about communities and their sense of cohesion, thinking about nations and their social discourse, thinking about the interplay between nations and the geopolitics and the economics, that all of the disruption that it could have. So I do want to make sure to reiterate that it is a moment of potential. It is also a moment of peril. And that's why it's so important that we get this right.
I'm thinking actually not simply technology or AI writ large in society, because of course, lethal autonomous weapons would be an affront to many of our values. But I'm thinking more in the faith and practice of religion and religious communities. So for example, Judaism is often an intergenerational conversation of commentaries on the Old Testament. So actually putting Maimonides and others into AI and having it respond sounds actually absolutely phenomenal in its practice. On the other hand, Quakerism, where there's spoken ministry, where someone stands up and says, friends, that is supposed to be the spirit speaking through the individual. And therefore, if they've used ChatGPT to identify what they wanted to say in a meeting for worship, that wouldn't really be quite right. That would actually be considered not on. So when you look at AI and how it's being used by religious communities, for example, by confessions, producing confessions and giving penitence, or writing homilies, what do you see as fabulous, go for it, but more importantly, what do you see as this is a little bit iffy and we want to rethink this?
I think there are ways in which we are utilizing AI to retrieve ancient religious texts and to make them more accessible, to translate them. I mean, for instance, there are vast collections of Buddhist texts that migrated over to a place called Nalanda and have been sitting and largely inert. The capacity to translate and then to analyze religious texts, make them available and accessible, I think is one very positive. And so certainly in the Christian space, you see that particularly on the translation side. I certainly would not view the composition, kind of the wholesale composition of sermons or homilies as a positive. I think that the process of wrestling with the text is important, but that's not to say that it cannot be a helpful aid, you know, a research assistant, a reviewer, and so on, and a source of feedback. And so, you know, I dabble in fiction writing, for instance, and I love the fact that if I want to give a realistic depiction of what somebody in a medieval desert setting might have eaten on a given, you know, at a certain socioeconomic level, I can find the answer like that. It used to take me forever to go and find those answers, right? So I, for instance, don't want to use it for the actual writing of language, the writing of story, because it feels very personal to me. But utilizing it for research is terrific. Now, there are other ways in which I think there are right and wrong ways of utilizing it within areas like mentoring and discipleship and mental health counseling, for instance. Some of the more negative ways might entirely replace human engagement. Some of the more positive ways might equip the mentor with, you know, resources that they might be able to pass along to the person that they are mentoring, or the counselor to the person that they are counseling. So those are helpful. I think ways of connecting religious congregations, let's say, with the communities around them and the needs that are found there are also probably beneficial, again, as long as it doesn't replace. And then there are all sorts of organizations like our own that are beginning to utilize machine learning for accessing just the data that they've collected over the years and surfacing different kinds of insights. And so I think if you're a nonprofit organization, let's say you're an organization like a World Vision or Compassion or Catholic Charities, they're probably some really beneficial ways of utilizing machine intelligence in those spaces too.
Tim, I need to thank you for a fascinating conversation. So this was absolutely stunning. To David and AI and Faith for bringing us all together, there's a thank you as well. Look forward to the next one.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Stay tuned to listen to more recordings and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share it with your friends. Don't forget to follow us on our social media as well. We're on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us today.